Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Sunday Edition, a monthly program of talks about books and topics of current and community interest. My name is Ira Lax. I'm substituting for Dietmar Wagner, the longtime host for this book event, who is in Germany for 2 weeks in mid-October. And so he's having a wonderful time, and I am very grateful to sub for him today to hear this particular author. And I work in the Community Relations Department of the library. Our programs take place on the second Sunday of the month from October through May. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Thomas Lynch. Thomas Lynch is the American Book Award winning author of The Undertaking. Today, Mr. Lynch will speak on his just-released book, Booking Passage, We Irish and Americans, a loving mixture of reminiscence, travel, history, cultural portrait, and meditation on what it means to be Irish, American, and Irish-American. Mr. Lynch, who is a funeral director in Milford, Michigan, has made numerous journeys to Ireland. In Booking Passage, he reflects on those journeys and reveals the binding ties of family, faith, language, and home place. He won the American Book Award for his 1997 book, The Undertaking, Life Studies from the Dismal Trade. The book was also a finalist for the National Book Award. And by the way, we have several of Mr. Lynch's books on sale out in the lobby on behalf of Nicholas Books. Mr. Lynch has also published 3 volumes of critically acclaimed poetry. Please welcome Thomas Lynch.
Thanks, Ira. Well, first let me thank Ira for that generous and vaguely obituarial introduction. It's always nice to hear such kindly things said about you in the present tense, and to be upright when you hear them is a good thing, too. Be outnumbered is also a real blessing, you know, for poets at poetry readings. We always figure wherever 2 or 3 are gathered is, you know, sufficient. So to be outnumbered by dozens is fit for the obituary. So, but you might, you know, this is a beautiful day. You could be doing so many different things. I'm very flattered, but you might want to, you know, check the medication, as they say. So anyway, my plan is to, handy, they have a clock up there. My plan is to read a little bit, and then maybe have some questions and answers, and the whole thing to be done in less than an hour. So on the subject of questions and answers, you can ask anything that you like, and if I don't have the answer, chances are we can find a book here about it. I can give you a reference, you know. If not, maybe I'll just make something up. In any case, you can't hurt my feelings. I've had teenagers. You can't offend me. I'll be gone in an hour, so if you've always, I mean, I do embalming and sonnets, and anywhere in between there is fair game, so ask away. This is your day. There's no meter running. And if you don't have any questions, I have at the ready the hour and a half poetry reading that is just waiting for the proper audience, so I'm armed and ready, so you might want to organize a couple Stump the Undertaker queries to avoid the long day that's in it for you if you don't. I'll just read a little bit of this, actually the introduction to this book, which is, the introduction is called The Ethnography of Everyday Life. The Center for the Ethnography of Everyday Life at the University of Michigan invited me to present at their recent conference, doing documentary work, Life, Letters, and the Field. Where I come from, upstream on the Huron from Smart Ann Arbor, we rarely offload words like ethnography unless we are appearing before the Zoning Board of Appeals or possibly going trying to avoid jury duty. All the same, I thanked the organizers and said I would be happy, etc., honored, of course, and marked the dates and times in my diary. To be on the safe side, I looked it up, ethnography. And it says, the branch of anthropology that deals with the description of various racial and cultural groups of people. And anthropology, I looked that up too, is the study of the origin, the behavior, and the physical, social, and cultural development of human beings. Anthology, a gathering of literary pieces, a miscellany, an assortment or catalog, is on the very same page as anthropology. It comes from the Greek, as students are told, for gathering flowers. As the man in that movie about the big fat wedding says, everything comes from the Greek for something else. Dictionaries are like that. You go in for a quick hit of ethnography and come out with flowers by the bunch. Two pages east and you've got Antigone, the daughter of Oedipus and Jocasta in Greek mythology, who performed funeral rites over her brother's body in defiance of the king at Thebes. That ancient city's on the same page as theater, or if you're British, theater, which have several definitions, all derived from the Greek for to watch. Think of the milieu of actors and playwrights. Think of Mrs. Patrick Campbell. Think Sophocles. At the Abbey Theatre in Dublin just last week, a new version of Antigone called The Burial at Thebes opened to great reviews in the Irish papers. One commentator claimed that Creon, the king, was like President George W. Bush, caught in a conflict he'd had a hand in making. How's that for ethnography and the everyday? How's that for life, letters, and the field? I avoided the quagmire of milieu, suspect as we are lately of anything French, but I looked up human and human beings and got what you'd guess, but came across humic, which sent me to humus, which has to do with a layer of soil that comes from the decay of leaves and other vegetation, and which contains valuable plant food. It is a twin to the Latin word, because everything in our house came from Latin, except, of course, the Kyrie, for soil, or earth. Which put me in mind of a book I'd been reading by Robert Pogue Harrison, called The Dominion of the Dead, in which he speaks about our humic density, we human beings, shaped out of earth, fashioned out of the dirt, because we are primarily bound to the ground our shelters and buildings and monuments rise out of and our dead are buried in. Everything, architecture, history, religion, rooted in the humus of the home place and to the stories and corpses that are buried there. Thus was I shown in my first days in West Clare years ago, the house and the haggard, the hay barn and turf shed, the cow cabins and out offices, gateposts and stone walls, fields and wells and ditches, forts and gaps, church and grave vault, names and dates in stone, all the works and days of hands that belong to the people that belong to me, all dead now, dead and gone, back to the ground out of which arose those emblems of humic density. Isn't that just like people, ethnographically speaking, or anthropologically, to think of the place where their ancients lived and worked, fought, believed, and are buried as sacred, central to their own identity? So, we're back to burials again, Antigone and Thebes, Creon and Bush. Do you suppose the humus is good for flowers? Such is the trouble with the everyday. One thing leads to another. You start out with ethnography and end up with flowers, like the paper white narcissus my true love grows every Christmas from bulbs she buries in a kitchen pot. Or the crocuses that press the litter of old leaves, pine needles and melting snow in the warming soil every year. The everyday, predictable, measurable truth assumes a routine that we think we can study. How the seasons change. The moon runs through its phases. The sun rises earlier every day. April showers, we say. Red sky at morning. Monday begets Tuesday, which in turn begets, you get it. We make our plans upon such reliable sciences. Home by Friday, with the help of God, I tell my darling on the way out the door. Maybe you want to know what I said at the conference. I said it looked like a paradigm shift. They were paying me a handsome honorarium. I said it looked like a paradigm shift from a sense of holy ground and grounding to a kind of rootlessness, spiritually, ethnographically, anthropologically speaking, humanity-wise, at which point in the proceedings I removed from my bag and placed upon the table by the lectern from which I was holding forth the open fairways, molded plastic, cremation, golf bag shaped cremation urn. Molded, no doubt, I actually had the thing itself, but it was removed from my possession a couple weeks ago on a flight back from Milwaukee. The airport security thought I might overtake the cabin crew with it, so I only have a picture of it now. Molded, no doubt, out of some new age resin or high-grade polymer, it stands about 14 inches high and looks like everyone's idea of the big nut brown leather bag with plump pockets and a plush towel and precious memories in which Dad or Grandpa or good old, insert the most recently deceased golf buddy's nickname, would have kept his good old golf clubs in. The bottom of the golf bag urn is fashioned to look like the greensward of a well-maintained fairway, so the whole thing looks like a slice of golf heaven. There is even a golf ball resting beside the base of the bag, waiting for the erstwhile golfer to chip it in for an easy putt. The thing is hollow, the better to accommodate the 200-some cubic centimeters, give or take, most cremated humans will amount to. I confess that the idea of the urn only came to me at the last moment, because I wanted to see the looks on their faces. It's a character flaw, based upon my own lack of scholastic pedigree. Except for an honorary degree in humanities from a university I never quite managed to graduate from, though the dear knows I paid for the classes, I hold no degrees. And though I am certified in mortuary science by a regionally respected university, a battery of state and national board exams, and the completion of a requisite apprenticeship, I'm self-conscious about standing before a room full of serious scholars and students. It is this fear, surely we all have it, of being exposed as a fraud that makes one eager to supply a diversion. Thus the urn. If I could not earn their respect. Still, I wanted to see the looks on their faces. When I presented as an article of documentary consequence, as an anthropological artifact, as a postmodern relic of a species that had accomplished pyramids, the Taj Mahal and Newgrange, the ethnographically denatured, and by the way, chemically inert, plastic golf bag-shaped cremation urn. It's one of a kind. It came from a catalog. There's also one that looks like a pair of cowboy boots, a companion urn for pardners, one that looks like a duck decoy for hunters or possibly naturalists, variations on the theme of molded plastic. So I wanted to tell them about the paradigm shift that I thought it signified. I came up burying Presbyterians and Catholics, devout and lapsed, born again and backslidden Baptist, Orthodox Christians and occasional Zen Buddhist and variously observant Jews. For each of these sets, there were infinite subsets. We had right old Calvinists who only drank single malts and were all good Masons and were mad for the bagpipes, just as we had former Methodists who worked their way up the Reformation ladder after they married into money or made a little killing in the market. We had Polish Catholics and Italian ones, Irish and Hispanic and Byzantine, and Jews who were Jews in the way some Lutherans are Lutherans for births and deaths and first marriages. My late father, himself a funeral director, schooled me in the local orthodoxies and their protocols, as I have schooled my sons and daughter who work with me. There was a kind of comfort, I suppose, in knowing exactly what would be done with you, one's ethnic and religious identities having established long ago the fashions and fundamentals for one's leave-taking. And while the fashions might change, the fundamental ingredients for a funeral were the same. Someone who has quit breathing forever, some others to whom it apparently matters, and someone else who stands between the quick and the dead and says something like, "Behold, I show you a mystery." An act of sacred community theater, Dr. Thomas Long, writer, thinker, and theologian, calls this transporting of the dead from this life to the next. We move them as if to a further shore. Everyone has a part in the drama. The dead get to the grave or fire or tomb, whilst the living get to the edge of a life they must learn to live without them. Ours is a species that deals with death, the idea of the thing, by dealing with our dead, the thing itself. late in the 20th century, there was some trending towards the more homegrown doxologies. Everyone was into the available choices. We started doing more cremations. It made good sense. Folks seemed less grounded than their grandparents, more portable, divisible, more scattered somehow. We got into balloon releases and homing pigeons done up as doves to signify the flight of the dead fellow soul towards heaven. Bridge over troubled water replaced How Great Thou Art. And if Paul's letter to the Romans or the Book of Job was replaced by Omar Khayyam or Emily Dickinson, what harm? After great pain, a formal feeling really does come, and it rings as true as any sacred text. A death in the family is, as Miss Emily observed, first chill, then stupor, then the letting go. Amidst all the high fashions and fashion blunders, the ritual wheel that worked the space between the living and the dead ran well and still got us where we needed to go. It made room for the good laugh, the good cry, and the power of faith brought to bear on the mystery of mortality. The dead were processed to their final dispositions with a pause sufficient to say that their lives and their deaths truly mattered to us. The broken circle within the community of folks who shared blood or geography or belief with the dead was closed again through this acting out our parts, as Reverend Long calls it. Someone brought the casseroles, someone brought the prayer, someone brought a shovel or lit the fire. Everyone was consoled by everyone else. The wheel that worked the space between the living and the dead ran smooth. Lately, I've been thinking that the wheel is broken or gone a long way off the track or must be somehow reinvented every day. The paradigm is shifting. What with distanced communities of faith and family, the script has changed from the essentially sacred to the essentially silly. We mistake the ridiculous for the sublime. Take Batesville Casket Company, for example. They make caskets and urns and wholesale them to funeral homes all over the globe. Their latest catalog is called Accessories, and it includes suggested visitation vignettes. The stage arranged around neither cross nor crescent or Star of David, but around one of Batesville's life symbols caskets, featuring interchangeable corner hardware. One life symbol looks like a rainbow trout jumping from the corners of the hardwood casket, and for dearly departed gardeners, there is one with little plastic potted mums. There is the sports dad vignette done up to look like a garage with beer logos and team pennants and hoops and hockey skates and, of course, a casket that looks a little bit like a jock locker gone horizontal. There's one for motorcyclists and the much-publicized Big Mama's Kitchen with its faux stove, kitchen table, and apple pie for the mourners to share with those who call. Instead of Methodists or Muslims, we are golfers now. Gardeners, bikers, and dead bowlers. The bereaved are not so much family and friends or co-religionists as fellow hobbyists and enthusiasts, and I have become less the funeral director and more the memorial caddy of sorts, getting the dead out of the way and the living assembled within a theater that is neither sacred nor secular, but increasingly absurd. A triumph of accessories over essentials, of stuff over substance, gimmicks over the genuine. The dead are downsized or disappeared or turned into knickknacks in a kind of funereal karaoke. Consider the case of Peter Payne. Dead at 44 of brain cancer, his wife arranged for his body to be cremated without witness or rubric. His ashes placed in the golf bag urn, the urn to be placed on a table in one of our parlors with his real life, which is to say his life-sized golf bag, standing beside it for their son and daughter and circle of friends to come by for a look. And if nobody said, doesn't he look natural? Several commented on how much he looked like, well, his golf bag. The following day, the ensemble was taken to church where the minister, apparently willing to play along, had some things to say about life being like a par 3 hole with plenty of sand traps and water hazards, to wit, all too short and full of trouble. And heaven was something like a 19th hole where, after finishing the course, those who played by the rules and kept an honest score were given their trophies. Then those in attendance were invited to join the family at the clubhouse of Mystic Creek Golf Course for lunch and a little commemorative boozing. There is already talk of a Peter Payne Memorial Golf Tournament next year. A scholarship fund has been established to send young golfers to PGA training camps. Some of his ashes will be scattered in the sand trap of the par 5 on the back 9 with the kidney-shaped green and the dogleg right. The rest will remain forever and ever perpetual filler for the golf bag urn. Whether this is indeed a paradigm shift, the end of an era, or as Robert Pogue Harrison suggests, an all-too-human failure to meet the challenges of modernity, is anyone's guess. But we are nonetheless required, as he insists, to choose an allegiance to either the post-human, the virtual and synthetic, or to the earth, the real, the dead in their elemental and humic densities. So, which will it be, I posed rhetorically, to the audience, which seemed oddly fixed upon the object de mort. The golf bag urn, read post-human, virtual and synthetic, or some humus, the ground, the grave, the fire, the village, the nation, the place or faith, the nitty-gritty real earth in which human roots link the present to the past and future. They looked a little blankly at me, as if I'd held up five fingers and asked them what the square root of Thursday might be. There was some shifting in their seats, some clearing of throats. I thought I might have numbed them with the genius of it or damaged them in some non-specific way. I thought about wrapping up with a little joke about a widow who brings her cheapskate husband's ashes home, pours them out on the kitchen table, and begins to upbraid him for all those things she'd asked for but never got, the mink coat, the convertible, etc., but thought the better of it, and closed instead with an invitation to engage in a little Q&A on these and other themes they might like to pursue. A man in the second row, whose eyes had widened when I produced the urn and who had not blinked or closed his mouth since the thing appeared, raised his hand to ask me, "Is there anyone in there?" "Why, no, of course not," I assured him. There was a collective sigh, a sudden flash of not quite knowing smiles, and then the roar of uneasy silence like a rush of air returned to the room. The director for the Center for the Ethnography of Everyday Life hurriedly rose to thank me for a thought-provoking presentation, led the assembled in polite applause, and announced that the buffet luncheon was ready and waiting in a room across the hall, except for a man who wanted to discuss his yet-to-be-patented water reduction method of body disposition. There was no further intercourse between the assembly and me. It's only now, months later, the conference come and gone, the kindly stipend paid and spent, that it occurs to me what I should have said. What I should have said is that ethnography seems so perilous just now, no less the everyday, that life, letters, and the field seem littered more than ever with the wounded and the dead, the raging and the sad. That ethnicity, formerly a cause for celebration, now seems an occasion for increasing caution. That ethnic identity, those ties by which we are bound to others of our kind, by tribe and race, language and belief, geography and history, costume and custom and 100 other measures, seems lately less a treasure and more a scourge. When I began this book, I had in mind one of those jaunty little travel logs that would give a little something back to the people that I've been stealing from for 35 years back and forth between the west of Ireland and here. And in fact, my brother had recommended to me sort of weekly audiences with himself that would eventuate in a book entitled Thursdays with Paddy. And my publishers really liked the idea, you know, the chance to make up, you know, for some of the losses they'd sustained on poetry over the years. And I was very keen on that. In fact, I saw a photo that appeared recently in the Irish Times of myself between my two donkeys, Charles and Camilla, I call them, that I keep in West Clare, named for the lovers on the neighboring island. And I thought maybe if I'd have called it Angelo's Asses, I would have done better with it. But The idea is that suddenly after the 11th of September 2001, which was about 8 or 10 months after I'd begun this book, its writing, it occurred to me that while ethnicity and tribe and race and sect and religion and creed and all those things by which we identify one another, all those adjectives that eventually subtract, you know, from humanity, that while they do connect strangers, do you know, beer-bellied, bald-headed, blue-eyed, freckle-faced fellows like myself can show up in any country in the world and say my name, and I'd immediately welcome in that particular pub or in that particular neighborhood or something like that. And the same is true for African Americans and Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans and everyone else who plays that ethnic card. But we sometimes forget, because we have in some ways grown up with it here, is that ethnicity has likewise poisoned the well of humanity. And that so much of what goes on around the world in the way of conflict has to do with all of the subtractions from basic humanity, you know, by which we say we are somehow other than the other. And I was reminded of this experience I had when we were kids. I mean, we used to spend Sunday afternoons such as today. We'd get my, you know, I was fortunate. I had two grandmothers who lived into their 90s, widowed women, who on Sundays we'd get them a little liquored up after Mass and bring them over to argue about politics or sex or religion, whatever was on the boards for the day. My father thought it was the kind of education we should have, because these women were opposites and their arguments were wonderful. My mother's mother was, an Irish-American woman from the Upper Peninsula. She was a Democrat and a teacher and an organizer of the teachers' union, and everything she did in the idolatrous style of the Irish. Whereas my father's mother was a Methodist woman who kept her own counsel, voted for Eisenhower, and, liked a quiet day spent among her seven and sevens, as they say. But they'd get arguing about it. I remember my father's mother telling me about her conversion, as it was called. The custom in her day was if a Protestant woman was marrying an Irish Catholic, she had to convert. And so she used to tell us about the experience of this conversion to what she'd call, with a proper dose of disdain, the one true faith. And she said, the priest splashed a little water on me, Tom, and said, Geraldine, you were born a Methodist and raised a Methodist. Thanks be to God, now you're Catholic. And some weeks after the eventual nuptials, she was out in the backyard grilling steaks for my grandfather on the first Friday in Lent, when the one of my grandfather's brother knights from the Knights of Columbus leapt over the back fence to upbraid her for the smell of beef rising out of a Catholic household in northwestern Detroit. She listened to your man and then went over to the garden hose, splashed some water on the steaks, and said, you were born cows. Raised cows. Thanks be to God, now you're fish. And sent the man on his way. So she would always use the story to set up her next line, which is that we are all God's children, whomever she is. And her second line, which is, and we are all the same but different. Now, when she'd say that, the same but different, I thought, the woman's cracked. You know, she's nuts. I heard it again in 1970 when I first went to West Clare to this little house that my great-grandfather had come out of. And I remember my cousin Nora, who had sort of prepped for this visit by this unknown Yank who had twisted relations back to names that she knew. And the house was unplumbed and unphoned, and there was no television. It was unencumbered by modernity in any way. It was a thatched roof, tiny stone building with flagstones set in mud, and it was damp, and it was February, and I didn't know how in the world I got to be there. And I remember her walking me into a room that had been prepared for my arrival. It was, you know, stone walls that had been whitewashed, and then on top of the whitewash, some paste had been put up to hold wallpaper with pumpkins on them. As she said, and it was, of course, bubbling and falling off and raveled up, and the wind was hissing under the door, and there was a cow calfing out in the barn. There were geese hatching in the clothes press. There was, you know, there was a litter of kittens everywhere. I just didn't, and I was either jet lagged or a little tipsy. I'm not sure, but I remember her saying clearly, "I see Thomas just like America, the same but different." And I remember hearing that again. This bizarre oxymoronic trope, the same but different. And the older I get, the more I am sure they had the launch code, the key to the mysteries of the universe, that everything, if you want to know the truth about it, it is the same but different. Everything. And the more I wrote this book, trying to think about tribe and sect and place and religion and creed and how we come to be such a hateful and vengeful and remarkable species. I kept thinking about the fact that we are all one and only and one of a kind. So we are all the same but different. And if we could figure out a way to, you know, to celebrate both, we'd be better off. Otherwise, of course, we're going to self-destruct as we seem to be doing. So the book changed in that way. And so through this book, while I tried to deliver up some of the Faith in Begorra pleasantries that any book about Ireland should include, it also includes some of the sadnesses, some of the changes that have taken place in this country and that country, and at least my sense of how they came to be. So there are chapters on one called Great Hatred, Little Room, after that wonderful poem of Yeats's, Remorse for Intemperate Speech, in which this stanza occurs. Out of Ireland have we come, great hatred, little room, maimed us at the start. I carry from my mother's womb a fanatic heart. And it was August of 31 that Yeats wrote that, and he was sort of between, you know, it was between wars, Europe, of course, and so he'd seen great hatred. I mean, the idea that the smaller the world gets, the smaller the place is, the more amplified the hatreds are, seems to be, you know, very topical today. The world has gotten very small, hasn't it, by miracles of communication and transportation. And yet the more distance we have collected because of our technologies, the more hateful it seems, or at least the more amplified our hatreds have become, and certainly the more lethal our weaponries have become. And so I think in many ways what was going on in Yeats's, in that August of Yeats's life, have a lot to teach us about what's going on in, you know, the 4th August of Afghanistan, the 3rd August of Iraq, the 5th August of our existence since George Bush was made president. We should be able to talk about those things, you know, and how we might mend ourselves. So anyway, I'll finish with a poem, and then this would be the time to figure out if you have any questions. Because I have a bag full of these poems. So this figure out if you have a question too. You'll know this poem's over because I'll stop. We are very fortunate over in Milford and in Highland, just north of us, that we have built two new libraries in the past 5 years. This was sort of my local library. I couldn't go to the Milford Library. It was a tiny collection for years. And also, whenever I'd get there, someone would have some business to do with me. Either they, you know, they wanted to prearrange their, you know, their obsequies, or they knew someone that didn't. So I could never really get... So I always came here to the library. I really love the collection here and love the book sales here. And love the restaurants around here, too. So this library I have nothing but fondness for. But when they built these two palaces to the bookish arts in Highland and Milford Township, I stopped coming here. And as sometimes happens, except for a guy who wrote a really fine auto parts manual, I was for many years the only published poet in our area. So I'm oftentimes asked to write something for the occasion. Like when the Dairy Queen's opens every year. You have something on that for us. But the Highland Township Library asked me to write something for their dedication of their library. So this poem is sort of based on that. And I've changed a little bit over the last couple of years to accommodate different audiences. But it's called To Be Among These Elegant Voices. Most of you know that wonderful Bruegel we have down in Detroit of the people dancing around at the wedding feast in the open. You know the one, this one, that one, you know. That's the only thing you need to know before this, okay. This image of the plump-faced peasantry, all knees and cod pieces dancing round someplace in Belgium at a wedding I found among the bees and artists European. The way the book is printed, how it's bound, is a matter of indifference to me. I want what's in it, the 1,000 words worth on every page, the contemplation of its creator's life and times, the memory of the moment I first beheld it in Detroit at the Institute of Arts, with that bookish girl I was trying to get, as we used to say then, biblical with. Was it 1970? Was it April? Was she as lovely as I remember? Was it, yes, that's it, oh yes, we whispered. Or have I confused her with another? But wait, the place is full of echoes now. Across the room among the W's, in English romantic poetry, Wordsworth is pacing out his iambic tune. The child is the father of the man, his footfall sounding in the garden's gravel while Keats and Coleridge proceed uphill. Or maybe it's that one word, biblical, that sets us rummaging through the scriptures. Job, that long-suffering protagonist, hapless, damaged, put upon by friends. Blessed be the name of the Lord, he yet insists in that vexing, God-awful, answerless book. It disturbed his people and disturbs us still. Sometimes, says Alan Duggan in a poem, disturbed people go to the public library. He's right, of course. Books can make us crazy or give us hope or make us question things. Where else but in our public library can we indulge our curiosities, imagination dancing in the round as one notion chases after others? To be among these elegant voices can get you going off in all directions and get you back somehow from whence you came. Take this place, for example. All these choices, hobbies, reference books, biography, fiction, magazines, all these places, people, names, shelved and silenced alphabetically, some dead and gone, still singing all the same. Emily Dickinson, Mark Twain, James Joyce, whose Molly and Leopold, whose Huckleberry, whose after great pain a formal feeling comes, become fresh fodder for our hungry minds, kindly guidance for our ruminations, timely as the moments that we occupy. Today it's mid-October. What else is new? My wife and I are going to a wedding. The world's supply of heartache is secure. There's love and hate and mayhem everywhere. It's good to dedicate some space to words, some rooms for visions and remembrances. It's good to look through windows on the world from a corner in a quiet place. Good to keep the records and corrected texts, histories and newspapers and ancient tracts of what we human beings were doing here. I was just browsing in American poets to find some good words for the nuptials, some verse by which to toast the newlyweds, when I came across this poem called The Dance by William Carlos Williams. What it says about the tweedle of bagpipes, about a bugle and fiddle and rollicking measures and Bruegel's great picture, the Kermis, makes me grateful for the things we find in books. This painting of peasants dancing in Flanders, the poems on paintings and marriages, the books therein, the places where the books are kept. So we've got about 15 minutes if anybody has any curiosities or a poem they knocked off this afternoon that they'd like to try. I'll repeat the question if you guys will have the kindness to ask it.
Going back and forth to Ireland and creating a country that has a share of ethnic and religious woes, and I just wondered what your, are you optimistic about things now?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, yeah, where there's life, there's hope. And certainly great progress has been made in the past, you know, 10 years. Not least because the difference between the you know, the haves and the have-nots has narrowed some. And we should count as, you know, a source of pride in this country that it was an American president who, after years of ignoring the Irish problem, the troubles, as they always called it, you know, with proper Irish understatement, that it was an Irish, it was a, an American president who said, who sort of brought the British to the table as honest brokers for the first time in history. When Bill Clinton said that he would send George Mitchell as a peace envoy to Belfast, Tony Blair said, good, we'll send someone to Los Angeles. And so then he said, well, I'll just send him as a, an economic advisor. Well, economics is something we all get behind, so he did. And suddenly the question of whether you're Protestant or Catholic, to which the answer was always, I'm atheist in Belfast. And they say, yes, but a Protestant or a Catholic atheist, you know. Suddenly that whole curiosity has given way to Visa or MasterCard. So yeah, there's real progress. Real progress. And in the Republic, the sort of the 26 counties to the south, they now, you know, they have for the first time in their history the problems of too much rather than the problems of too little. And for the first time in anyone's memory, people are trying to get in there instead of out of there. And which brings a whole new set of problems, you know. How do you deal with the Latvian Irish? Or the Lithuanian Irish, or the Nigerian Irish. So yeah, I'm very, very hopeful. I mean, in Milford this year, they opened a new Irish bar called O'Callaghan's, and it's owned by two Palestinians who had the good sense to hire two boyos from Mayo to come over and, you know, pull pints for the locals who, for whom somehow it's cheerier to be drunk as an Irish person than it is to be, you know, just drunk on a Thursday. So, and it's, business is going flying, and I thought, well, isn't this very American? Isn't this very Disney? Isn't this very virtual, synthetic, faux, you know? Until, you know, I went to my local in West Clare last April, and the Long Dock in this little fishing village, and the man working the bar was from Lithuania. And he was waiting for friends from Poland to come and help with the summer business. And I think maybe it's like Bartenders Without Borders. Maybe maybe there is truly hope for the world, you know? So yeah, I'm very hopeful. Anything else? Any other curiosities? Yes. That's a really, I'm glad you asked that, because it goes to the power of language again. Actually, it was the tiniest thread of remembrance that had sort of kept the connections. When I, Sunday dinners for my brothers and sisters and me were always at my grandfather's and grandmother's house in Detroit. And the grace before these massive turkey dinners, you know, was always, you know, the standard Catholic grace before meals, and then he would end with, don't forget your cousins, Tommy and Nora, on the banks of the River Shannon. Now, he wouldn't know Tommy and Nora from Shem and Sean. He wouldn't know the banks of the Shannon from the Detroit River. He'd never been there. He'd never met them, but he'd been told by his father, who came out of that house, not to forget these two, this brother and sister, these cousins, Tommy and Nora on the banks of the River Shannon, etc., etc. So always in my remembrance was that I had this connection to some place called the banks of the River Shannon. And so when in December of 1969, I got a high number in the Nixon draft lotto. Do you remember that? By which men of my generation got to, you know, sort of play, you know, the lottery with their likelihood of mortality. When I got a high number and knew I wouldn't be going to Vietnam, I thought, well, now I can go someplace. I'll have to go to Ireland. So it was my grandmother who still had the address for these people, Moveen, West Kilkee, County Clare, Ireland. So, you know, I took a one-way ticket and went to Ireland. I had $100, spent 12 of it on the cab out to West Clare, handed the guy the address to take me there, you know, from the airport. And, you know, I was undereducated, underfunded. I had no ticket home and no prospects. In 1970, it was February, wrong season. And if I had been Tommy and Nora, this spinster and bachelor living on their own at the edge of the world, I'd have said, come in for tea and then sent me on my way. But they took me in. They actually kept me for 4 months. And it was like reestablishing connections. So that was very, but it had not been for that little thread of remembrance. And don't forget your cousins, Tommy. So, one of the things I'm most grateful for is that at least for the next generation or so, I've done my part as far as keeping the record, and what they do with that is their business. Yeah. So, yes.
You talk a lot in your book about being Irish and Catholic, this relationship. My family was from Cork and was Protestant,
mm-hmm.
and I still wonder what you think about what is it, this pull that has those of us who are Irish American for Ireland.
Well, I think part of it has to do with the downright beauty of the place, you know, that sort of strange beauty of the home place, that it's a manageable sized jewel, you know. It's not like when you go to Ireland, you can do it. You can do the tour. But the other thing is, with the except of the forced migration of slaves, the immigration of the Irish to this country was the largest migration in our nation's history. And while it was not forced in the sense that they were, you know, gathered up, put in slave ship holds and sent, they were without choices. They either starved or went. Those were the options then. And so for, 44 million Americans, they have this connection. And when people come away from a place not by choice but of necessity, then I think the pull of the home place is probably greater. So, you know, the idea of an American wake, which was still had currency in 1970. I mean, when the night before I left, after the 4 months I spent there, it was, you know, the sense that I would never be seen again in those places. And it was true, really, up until not too long ago, that when somebody left, they didn't come back. Because both the ones that left and the ones who stayed had this sort of built-in guilt, you know. And interesting dynamics, really. I mean, I could always return because I had been gone, in a sense, for three generations. So when I came back, I was a Yankee. But the one who went away and, you know, at 18 and came back with a pension and Social Security and, you know, the pretense of an American life, that was always the Yank. And it was not a kindness to be, you know, it was not a... So immigration was a scourge. I mean, it really did do damage to family ties. And when I look at the difference between the generation that left, you know, my great-grandfather's sort of the narrative arc of that family life compared to the one that stayed, it's very interesting. I mean, it is a great country, as they say, this one. But I think that pulled particularly among the Irish. But maybe it's just the one we know, you know, because I'm certain it's the same for other people who have other hyphenated Americans, you know. So, anything else?
Your love of language is conveyed so magically, and I wondered when it first came to you. Is it?
I think it is. I do think of language as the gift. You know, in the beginning was the words. Good. I really do think it's the it is the one. But I do remember. You know, not only bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts. But the better rhymes were, you know, like, angel of God, my guardian dear, to whom God love commits me here. And I didn't have a clue what that meant. I was instructed, it wasn't magic, of course, it was prayer, but I was instructed that that would keep me from dying in the night and all the other grim things that could happen. I could care less. I loved the sound of it, you know. And if you listen closely to that, I mean, when I went next door to stay at Mike McGall's house, it was, "Now I lay me down to sleep and pray the Lord my soul to keep." And at Jimmy Shrack's house, instead of saying, you know, the grace we said before, they say, "God is great, God is good, let us thank him for this food." Made me, they said food, but I admired the, I took on board that, you know, Protestants could do off rhyme. You know, I like that idea, you know. But the same sort of magical formulas. I mean, if you listen closely, "God is great, God is good, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, twinkle, twinkle, little star, now I lay me down to sleep. Irish poets, learn your trade, sing whatever is well made. Earth receive an honored guest, William Yeats is laid to rest." All these things tie in together, you know. People won Nobel Prizes making up the same sort of rhyme and meter by which we learned our ABCs, or our grace before meals, or whatever it was. So, for me, language was always magical. And I remember this boy in West Clare once, I was doing a class, and he raised his hand and said, "And when did you get your poetic license?" You know, he was like, and his class did exactly what you just did, which made the teacher blush, and he said, "Hey, everybody be quiet." You know? But he knew that that license with language is nothing, it is magical. It's like driving a tractor or walking the coast road. It gives you powers, you know. And so, yeah, I've always regarded it as a great, good gift that we all get. I mean, I told him, we all get this, but we don't all, I mean, other people do other things, but for me, the words are really fun. Yes?
I was at Belfast last summer, and I was so intrigued by the huge murals and their tributes and their statues and everything they've done to remember everything that's happened there. I don't feel that in America. I mean, I don't feel that here in Ann Arbor. I guess I'm not sure what my question is, except I'm just saying, do you have that sense when you're in Ireland that there's just a different type of appreciation for the loss of life and for living?
Well, you could go to Washington, which is nothing but a, you know, sort of a standing cemetery, you know. We do monuments well, too, but out here, you know, we do them less because there's, I mean, we're that far into the Midwest where less monumental things apparently have happened, or at least the source of granite is farther away, you know. But, of course, there's the irony in Ireland also that in Belfast they will remember every outrage, you know. Somebody who insulted somebody, who killed somebody, and that, you know, that goes on the wall, that, you know. But then they will pass, you know, Easter Monday, which is essentially their 4th of July, without a word, for fear of enraging people. When in 1998 Bill Clinton made a visit to Ireland, now this was after the First Friday Agreement, it was the peace had broken out in the country, and he was doing the kind of victory lap, you know, for every good reason. But he was going to play Ballybunion's golf course, which is immediately across the Shannon River from the house I have. And on the way to Ballybunion, there's a hairdresser's called Monica's. Do you know they took the sign down? Because they know what's in a name. And they didn't want to give offense. And it was just the done thing. So, yeah. Oh, yeah, because in Ireland languages, you know, there is the message, and then there's the message, and then there's the message. and it's all layered. And wouldn't we just? Yes. Yeah.
In your time spent in Ireland, can you notice a specific rhyme, the language is a language of music? And I know when I was there in the 70s, one thing that struck me was as if I was in a musical score because of the way the people communicated with one another. And I'm not a scholar in the poetic sense, but I'm wondering if you notice a particular specific to the meter as people communicate with one another in Ireland.
Well, it is a country that had its own language, of course. I mean, a century ago, the townland that I'm in was probably 70% Irish-speaking. So many of the idioms and tropes are Irish, native Irish, that have been sort of enhanced by their understanding of English. So it is the colonizer's tongue, but they've taken it and run with it more or less. The other part of that is that everyone has to have a party piece. Because there was no television, and because the days are as long there as they are here, the evening would be spent in talk and song. So you better have a song or a story or a poem or some news, because and just to deliver it like this happened and then that happened would be an offense to everyone. People would fall asleep. So the ornamentation of conversation is something that, particularly in the west of Ireland, they have raised to an art form. And that is the good news and the bad news, because you can ornament the most hurtful things. They will sound like, they will have a certain lilt to them, you miserable son of a bitch. I mean, but oftentimes the worst dagger is hidden in this lovely sort of speech. So there is, you have to build into it a decoding device to know what it is they're saying, you know. But yes, they have the idea that the language was to be heard. It was long before it was a written and read thing, it was a heard, a said thing. And so the bardic tradition that comes out of Scotland and Wales and Ireland owes to the idea that the evening news was said out loud. It wasn't produced in papers. And it's maybe one of the reasons why the Irish sort of owned the century of language in terms of literature for the last, and why probably the Scots will have it this coming one, you know, because they're much the same. Yes?
I've been taking magazine America, Irish American, for a couple of years. They were talking about immigration, and it's like, I think we're overtaken with Irish. And it doesn't occur to me when I see a person that person has just gone a second. Kevin Kline, for instance.
Yes.
And so I just want to think that that's global for anyone. It's just a wonderful magazine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Ah, well, it's there. That's for sure. And they take the language seriously. So that part of it's very good. No. Yes. Yes, yeah. Aren't they great liars? Maybe one more question. Yes.
I have a question about, do you write more when you're there than when you're here? You know, you're working? In Ireland?
Well, there's longer parts of the day, you know, that I don't have any. And over there, you know, when I'm there, I'm almost entirely as... I mean, Nora Lynch used to sort of uphold my rights to be at what she called the poetry business, which meant that no one could disturb me during the day when I was just lollygagging around. But in the night time, you could. But they still observed the same thing. The whole parts of the day were reading and writing is all that you have to do. And but I really do think, and I think it should be said in a library, that you know, writers are only readers who go karaoke. They are just—they've heard all these voices, and they try to steal as many as they can. And that really is the core of poetic license: is that you hear something you want to say like that or better. And so you want to take part in this conversation. Over there, the conversation is easier because the phone's not ringing and there's no traffic and stuff like that. But it is still pretty much a portable art, you know. Any writer is walking around with this other conversation going on between their ears. And I mean, the only reason I wanted to write books was to explain myself to my children who always wondered why I was looking sort of at their ear. You know, they go, "You're doing that again, Dad." You know, but what it was is I was sort of preoccupied with another conversation. So.
That's all the things you go through.
I'm very fortunate there, because in a way that maybe, you know, selling solar heat windows wouldn't, being around people at that particular intersection in their family's history has always been for me, you know, I thought it was like a trust I was taken into, and I still feel that way. Anyway, thanks for your attention. Good night. God bless.
For a complete listing of upcoming events at the Ann Arbor District Library, visit our website at www.aadl.org or call the library at 734-327-4200, press option 3 for events listings.